It isn't what we say or think that defines us, but what we do. Jane Austen. This is the What We Do podcast by Kira K. Dixon. In episode 2, you heard the beginning of Abe Arrington's story. I couldn't think of a better way to end the miniseries than hearing how everything turned out for Abe. Let me tell you, he got a major improvement on his legal team.
So I had these lawyers that had heard about me and everything, and it was a very, very good legal team. Gail K. Johnson from Johnson & Klein up in Boulder, Aurora Randolph, and Katie Stifle, they actually signed on. They came and talked to me and everything, and we started having, you know, conversations about my case, my overall situation. And they basically had said, well, let's go ahead and try to see if we can get you clemency first to get you out as soon as possible. Because seeing that my case had been so heavily litigated all the way up to the 10th Circuit, they were like, this can take years trying to fight just to get you back in court. So they decided to file the clemency. And like they said, and we all knew this. I knew it. They said, hey, it's a long shot. It's just a long shot, but let's try it. And they filed it. Within 2 years, almost 2 years to the date that they filed it, you know, is when I got the call, you know, when they called me down to the warden's office and said that it had been granted.
What was that moment like?
It was very emotional, to say the least, because, you know, after everything I've been doing and fighting for so long, you know, to try to get out and prove my innocence and all this other kind of stuff like that. And I remember I was at work. I was with the lady who was my boss, real nice lady, too. Her name is Ruby. She's a correctional officer. She said, Mr. Arrington, I need to talk to you. She said, you need to make a phone call. She escorts me to the warden's office. So he asked me immediately, he says, did you file for clemency? And I told him, I said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, well, just sit down. I think they have to ask you some questions. He said, they do this kind of stuff all the time. And that's what I thought it was going to be. That's what everybody in the room thought. It was just me, him, and a major. And we all thought they were going to, you know, interview me and talk about, you know, maybe some circumstances or situation of my case, my charge, what I was going to do when I got out and everything like that. And it was a shocker, because they just told me as soon as we called up, and the governor's lawyer introduced herself, and she said, Mr. Arrington, I called to inform you that the governor has decided to grant you clemency, and you will be eligible for parole as of Monday. And so now in my mind, I remember thinking this, because a lot of the guys who got...
Abe's immediate reaction was not to jump for joy. He knew a lot of prisoners that had been granted clemency and were still waiting to get out. Essentially, those incarcerated people were now eligible for parole and still had to go through that process. It is rare to be let out immediately.
He said, you'll be eligible for parole last Monday. In my mind, I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, I'll be going up for parole for about maybe the next 5 years. Maybe I might get out after 5 or 6 years. And she immediately shut that down by saying, I want to make it clear, Mr. Arrington, that you've been granted a rare clemency, that even though you are eligible for parole as of Monday, even if they refuse to parole you, you will be mandatory released no later than March 1st. That's when it became real emotional for me. I really lost it, because I was like, on home. So, yeah, I couldn't believe it. The warden, his mouth was dropped. You know what I mean? And the major, they were both looking at me. They're like, wow. They literally said, they said, I've never seen this happen before. And I mean, they congratulated me and everything. And they were like, man, they said, I can't even imagine how you feel, because I'm shocked. That's what they were telling me. They said, this has never happened. They said, they never do it like this. And so I'm crying. I'm emotional. I'm like, but here it is, 30 years. I've been fighting through my innocence. You know what I mean? And I still get emotional thinking about it.
I can only imagine that your family just was weeping tears of joy.
Oh, yeah, everybody was just going crazy, you know, especially, like I said, my dad, my brother, my sister, my mother. It was like having an enormous weight taken off of you. I mean, I can't even begin to explain that to you. I mean, just to really just have this opportunity.
Now that Abe is out after 30 years, I asked him what have been some of the more surprising things on the outside.
The technology takes some getting used to. I took a computer class, what, maybe 20 years ago in prison? It's not relative anymore. You know what I mean? It's not even valid. So
yeah.
I was like probably like about half an hour out of prison. My brother and sister came down to pick me up. They picked me up down at the gate, down at Territorial Correctional Facility. And we drove up the street immediately because they wanted to get me out of my prison clothes. They had bought some clothes for me, and I changed at this gas station. And so I come out of there, and then we immediately go to, I think it was a Walmart. And we stopped out there because my brother had to get something or another. And I decided, I might as well go in the store and I'll go look for it, because my brother, he gave me a little pocket change or whatever. And so I was like, man, I'll go in here, maybe see if there's something that I like, I want to eat, or, you know, grab a snack or something. So I go into the Walmart and I'm walking around and I'm just like, you know, I mean, because that's just something new, just being able to shop. And I'm looking at everything and, you know, just having choice is really crazy for us, you know, inmates, ex-incarcerated or, you know, whatever people. And having all these choices, I'm looking at it, and that's all fine and everything. So I pick up some chips or something. So I'll get these chips, and then I start. Like I said, I get ready to go try to get, she said, cash out. And I'm like, how do I do this? I had no idea.
Don't feel bad, Abe. I also struggle with the self-checkout.
Hey, I hit the Pepsi lady up. I said, hey, can you help me? She says, I'm sorry, sir. I'm just stocking the Pepsi. I said, okay. And somebody started pointing out to me how to do it. And I've heard guys tell me that they were embarrassed. Me, I was just so marveled at everything. I was laughing. I was really humorified. I said, wow, this is crazy. They want me to check this stuff out myself. So they're showing me how to scan it. And I'm just smiling. I'm like, okay, that's pretty cool. You know, and so I go ahead and do that, to do the self-checkout and everything. And I finally walk out, and I was like, wow, that was crazy. I just got my own stuff at the darn store. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, he told us this really cute story when we first met up with him when he got out. His brother and sister picked him up, and they were in the car, and his brother turns around and hands him his new cell phone and says, Abe, you know, here's your new cell phone. I know it looks kind of weird. We'll go over how to use it later. And you have a MacBook at home, too. And Abe responds and goes, oh, that's so great. I really need to read a book about how to use the computers nowadays, because I'm sure they're just so much different from when I was using computers. And his brother explained to him, you know, a MacBook is a computer. And we Zoomed the other day. Like, he's picking, obviously he's so smart, but he's just picking stuff up quick as a whip.
We had a mutual friend, and this guy, I know.
Remember Abe's flood mitigation system that he invented from prison? I wanted to know how his venture is going, and if he's putting those Defy skills to good use.
We started talking, and he said, yeah. He said, Les told me that you had some kind of patent or something. And I said, yeah, I got a patent. And we started talking about it. And he started, well, you looking for investors? And I was like, well, not really right now. You know, I was kind of, you know, leery, I guess you say, standoff. It's like, man, I'm going to wait till I get out and see what I want to do. And we ended up talking a couple times after that. We kept talking, and the more we kept talking, he asked me about details, explained everything to him, I explained it to him. And finally, like, so we just keep talking about it over the course of like a few weeks. And finally, he says, man, I can help you with this. I really can. He said, you know, I can do that. We can get a contract drawn up, make it legal and everything, man. I can get you the money, the financing that you need. And we estimated it's probably going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood like almost $500,000. And he said, yeah, I'll give you that. He said, he said that kind of matter of factly like that. And I was like, is this guy for real or what? And he's like, no, I can do that. All right. So we set up a business account, and he started putting the money in there. And next thing you know, we're talking to people from the
National. Abe's invention is now a real business. And with help from his investor, business is booming. If Abe can manage to get a patent from prison, I have a feeling Abe is going to be very successful. In the meantime, Abe is also doing some very impactful work.
There's a great nonprofit organization. It's called Second Chance Center in Denver. It helps people with reentry. It helps homeless people. It helps people, you know, deal with addiction problems, all kind of things like that. It's like almost like a one-stop shop place to help people, you know, who are dealing with any number of social, you know, and emotional issues in their lives and stuff like that. Even economic issues. Help people sometimes with housing, a whole lot of things. I mean, there's a whole lot. And it was started by a guy who was actually, I was incarcerated with for a very long time, named Hassan Abdul Latif, another one named Sean Ashi Taylor. Those guys that started that, and there's another guy, you know, Adam Abdullah. These guys put together this center, and it's turned into this real vibrant place for the community. and people would come in there, you know, and could get a good meal or coffee and, you know, use, they had a computer lab and they, all these different things. They did advocate, you know, they were advocates for mine, you know, while I was incarcerated and, you know, instrumental, you know, in helping with my release, which I'm, you know, very thankful for. And not only that, when I, you know, when I got out, they're like, hey, you know, we know, you know, who you are, you know, and what you're about. So, you know, one job. And I was like, yeah, definitely, you know. And so they said, no, you'll be perfect for this, you know. And they said, because, you know, you, for the years we've known you, you know, we knew you years in prison, and you, a lot of times you were doing the same thing, counseling people or whatever the heck while you were there. So you might as well come out and do it right now. And so they offered me the job. And so that's what I'm doing right now. So I do that. And it's great. You know, it really is. You know, I work with a lot of really, really great people. You know, it's rare when you can actually really honestly say that you actually love working with all the people that you work with, all of them. And so that's what I do. Person gets out of prison, they call the center. They can try to get help with job placement. We try to help them get clothes. We try to help them get food, shelter, all those kind of things, because some people are just released out of prison and they might not be from Colorado. And they said, well, you got to be on parole out here. And they might not have people out here, or they might not have, they've been in jail for a long time. A lot of their loved ones, close ones might have passed away. We help them get on their feet and help them try to get on with their lives. That's what we do. And that brings a lot of joy to my heart to be able to do that.
I thought it was pretty wonderful that Abe's connections through prison were able to help set him up with such a strong support system on the outside. Stacy and Defy were also able to hire someone from one of their cohorts.
We have a really wonderful guy who was at, I'm sure that you met him. His name is Nick, and he was at Arkansas Valley. And he was always super involved in cohort when he was in EIT and when he graduated. And then he came back as a peer facilitator and helped the second cohort get through. And then he got granted parole at the very end of last year and started working for us at the beginning of January.
Oh my gosh, doing what?
Yeah. So he's our senior operations associate. He manages everything that is technology and helps to streamline all of our back office and identify like best operational practices so that we can have more scalable systems in place and continue to expand into other facilities. The best part of our job is the EITs that we get to work with. And he's like here in, you know, linking arms with us and figuring it out. So it's amazing.
How has the last year changed for you personally with your role?
So before, I was the program director and I was focused solely on delivering the best program that I possibly could to our EITs inside the facilities and also our released EITs, creating strategic partnerships with community members. And at the end of the year last year, our founding executive director, Bob Omer, stepped down, and it was so difficult to see him go because I admire Bob and I look up to him in so many ways. And he really helped to shepherd my own personal and professional growth over the past year. It was a year and a half that we worked together before I became the executive director. And so there was definitely some growing pains in that regard, but it's also been extremely empowering and exciting to be able to call the shots. Like, I have a big long-term vision for the impact that I want this organization to have on the criminal justice system and on our society as a whole in the way that it interacts with people with criminal histories. And it's very encouraging to be able to steer the boat and to collaborate with all of our stakeholders, the Department of Corrections, our entrepreneurs in training, our mentors, our donors, and our staff to realize that vision as a group. And it's been so much fun. And the first thing I did was hire Nick. So like, I don't know how it gets any better than that.
Abe and Nick getting real jobs out of prison is not often the case, so I wanted to know how DeFi is helping set people up for success beyond the program inside.
The way that the criminal justice system is set up now makes it really, really difficult for people to be employable when they come out of prisons. There are opportunities for education and for jobs while they're inside. But let's just use Nick, our new employee, as an example. He built and maintained an entire website for the Department of Corrections. They have a furniture manufacturing business inside the facilities, and they sell their furniture to various different contracts via this website, right? So Nick was building and maintaining it. And he had two supervisors that were correctional officers overseeing him in his day-to-day work operations. The rules for the Department of Corrections, in Colorado at least, as they stand now, is that when someone is released, they cannot have contact with anyone that they were in contact with while they were inside. So those two correctional officers that oversaw his work for the past 12 years cannot serve as a reference for him. So when people are coming out of prisons, their resume is going to look really different because it's going to say the state of Colorado. So someone knows automatically that they were in prison, and they can say, I did really great work, but they don't have anyone to call and talk to about that. So the wonderful benefit about DeFi and what we do is that we are able to see people's work ethic. We're able to see the areas in which they really excel at while they're inside. And since we are a third-party organization that's not part of the Department of Corrections, we are not subject to following that rule. So when someone gets out and goes to apply for a job, they can put down Stacy Putka, Executive Director of DeFi Colorado, will be my reference. So we're able to maintain a little bit of a bridge and help people with employment right away.
When all is said and done, the whole point of this series has been to shed some light on the experiences of many of those inside and maybe contribute to breaking a cycle. I asked Abe what his hope for this moment is.
Culturally, you know, this is something that people really need to really talk about and think about and say, okay, well, would you accept this if the people in this incident, if the races were different? Because if George Zimmerman were a black man and he stopped a young white girl walking down the street and started asking her where you're going and stuff like that, he's automatically said, you're some kind of a sex offender or something like that, or you have some kind of issue. Or, you know, at the very least, you know, they would just say, all right, you should not be stopping this young lady and asking her anything. She hasn't done anything. You know what I mean? She's just going about her business, and you should not be, you know, interrogating her. But for some reason, if it's a black man or a young black man in this country, culturally, that's considered to be acceptable. We need to get to a point where it's not acceptable. If he hasn't done anything, leave him alone. And, you know, and that's what I'm fond of telling people. Hey, I'm going to help the police department out by telling you this. You know what I mean? I'm going to save you time. I'm going to save you man hours. If you see me, I'm not doing anything. Just leave me alone. Go about your business and you can keep going, doing whatever. Go find somebody who actually is committing a crime. You know what I mean? And, you know, and do that, you know, and it save everybody a whole lot of grief, you know, and so that's the way I look at it. Just, you know, just switch to people in the actual scenario and you'll see how ridiculous it actually is that people actually expect, you know, black people just to, you know, in particular black men to have to give an impromptu interview, you know, at any given time. And I think when people just recognize that we just have rights, not privileges, rights, walk down the street and not be molested or accosted or questioned by anyone because they feel like they're afraid or this person's out of place or shouldn't be here or shouldn't be there, what have you. And also when you recognize the right that we also have the right to defend ourselves in those situations. And that's what we really need to get to in America, you know, in this country, you know, and hopefully a lot of things with the demonstrations are taking us in that direction. That's what I would actually hope for.
I also put this question to Brittany.
I think the most important thing to do is to have conversations with people. But it is study. It is learning about it. It is reading about it. It's watching documentaries about it. It's engaging it. You know, I've come to find that some of the people that are the loudest and the most outspoken on these topics are individuals who, you know, grew up in a homogeneous community where they might have been one or two token minority families. So they're not really engaging on a day-to-day or weekly basis with people of color. So they're growing up in a homogeneous community. You know, their only way of understanding any of these issues is typically through media, which is deeply problematic because the media is not able to contextualize these things. And we know certain networks specifically are looking to not contextualize these issues. And then they've never read a single book about any of these topics. So sometimes I think it's really important to just ask the question, hey, is my opinion correct? And if I think it's correct, how am I justifying it? Have I actually done any research on this topic? And not research in terms of I'm watching Fox News, because news stations are not places of study. I would recommend people studying by grabbing books that are written by scholars that have been spending literally their entire life answering these questions, going in and looking at primary source documents, you know, seeing the behind the scenes conversations with how these laws are made, how these things came to be to formulate their opinions. I don't actually know any other way for people to get better besides learning about these systems, reading about them. If you're not someone that's a big book person, it's hard for you. Find articles on the topic by those same scholars. Typically, they'll have shorter articles that are 15 pages. You know, make it a part of your schedule. You know, I'm going to commit to reading one article on one of these different topics every week, every 2 weeks. I think that's how we get better at this as a country. And I think that's how people end up feeling more comfortable talking about race, you know, being empowered by the information. The white community reading about these things and learning about these things is only going to help the citizens of the country, because then you're not going to hear things like all lives matter. You're not going to hear, well, I'm colorblind and I don't get this, right? And again, that's privilege, because people of color don't, you know, we don't get to say, I don't get this. It's, I have to get it. I live it. I have to figure out how to survive in it. Literally. Normalize being able to say, hey, I don't know about this. I haven't read about it. I have been privileged. I have been blind, but I'm here now and I'm stepping up now and I'm committed to this. And this isn't just a thing for social media. This isn't just a thing while it's popular in the news. This is a thing that makes me a better person. It makes me a better citizen. It makes me a better human. It makes me a better Christian, Muslim, whatever it may be. And that's why I need to do this.
It sounds so simple when Brittany says it, but standing up and saying, I'm here now, and meaning it, can lead to lasting impact. It takes a little courage, but it's not impossible to start contributing. I named this show What We Do after a Jane Austen quote. The quote says, "It isn't what we say or think that defines us, but what we do. What we do now, not just personally, but as a nation, will continue to define us. So speak out against injustice, vote, participate, or just have a conversation at home. No act is too small in helping to build a better, more loving world." As you heard, the last four episodes were not the project I originally set out to do. And also, I've been so nervous to put this out. I've listened to it about 1,000 times, and it's probably not perfect. Who am I to create content in this space? But if I'm listening to Brittany, it seems like not using my platform as an opportunity to be here, to spread goodness, knowledge, and awareness would be a waste. And I think that fear of joining the conversation and speaking up has been the very fear that has allowed these issues to continue festering for so long. If we're not talking about them, we can easily push them out of sight, out of mind. So this time, I don't want to push it away, and I don't want to just post a little black box on Instagram. Instead, it's time to live by that quote and actually do. I want to thank Stacy Putka, Brittany Lewis, and Abe Arrington for participating in this series. Thank you to Dayton Cole and Resonate Recordings for helping me put together a very complex story. Thank you to former Governor John Hickenlooper and former head of the Department of Corrections in Colorado, Rick Ramish. Thank you to the Colorado Department of Corrections for supporting DeFi's work and for approving the content you heard recorded in prison on this podcast. Most of all, thank you to the men of Colorado State Penitentiary and Arkansas Valley Correctional Facility for giving us your stories and your voices. You are seen, heard, and loved. What We Do is mixed and mastered by Resonate Recordings. Interested in starting your own podcast? As a What We Do listener, you can go to resonaterecordings.com to get your first episode produced for free. Just let them know we sent you. If you have a podcast or are considering starting one, I can't recommend them enough. They are amazing audio engineers that understand podcasting like no one else. Go to resonaterecordings.com to get your first episode produced for free today.